Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
So tonight we are going to be talking about why it's important to diversify your interests. And I wanted to start, I don't want to be too sardonic, but there's this great anecdote that keeps coming up in my head. And it's when I heard an interview with Susan Sontag about putting on Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo during the war there. And she was being interviewed along with the theater director. And the interviewer asked, why would you ever put on a play during wartime? You know, it's dangerous to come out. Your actors are starving. And the theater director said, you know, there's a misconception that during war, the most important thing is staying alive. And he said, it's actually remaining human in each moment. And I thought that was so good because we sometimes forget, you know, like, what is it that makes us human, especially when we're consuming all of this news and a lot of it is really horrific and terrible. But it is important that we remain human in each moment, and we're going to kind of be talking about that tonight. So let me introduce two guys on your head, Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke. Welcome. I was going to do some elaborate, you know, introduction, but instead I decided to have you both introduce yourselves with 7 words that describe you. Did you actually do this? Because I did ask.
I already said it to you.
Yeah, but you can't use that one. You have to use it up. Okay. So do you have your 7 words?
I'll let R start.
Okay.
Well done. Witty. Oh, that was me. Sorry. No. Collaborative, I would say. There we go. Verbal.
So you got
collaboratively verbal. I'm a psychologist, sax player, organizer, all around nice guy. That's like 6 more words.
All around nice guy.
Yeah, I was 9.
A mathematician.
You went over.
Not a mathematician.
What about you, Bob?
Old, bald, joyful.
Subversive.
Yeah.
Subversive.
Joyful, subversive. How many I got? 4?
4.
Okay. Useful.
That's good.
Yeah, useful. I'm useful. I'm useful.
Some pig.
Some pig. That's it. Curious and employed.
Oh, that's always good.
How about that? Always good.
Yeah.
I have good news and bad news.
What? Did you see something? Okay.
So that's a better introduction than I would have come up with.
You sure? I can't say the thing I was going to say.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, so she wrote to us today and said, let me ask you to say 7 words that define you or describe you. Is that what
yeah.
she said?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe this actually added up to 7 words. And I wrote back to her, there once was a man from Nantucket. And she didn't accept that. I don't. Okay. That was 7.
It has to be a thoughtful 7. Not just any 7, but
okay.
I liked your 7.
All right. All right. Okay.
Okay, so getting on with it, what do we mean when we're talking about diversity and diversifying what our interests are? Like, what does that really mean?
Well, I think for most of us, we have things as we grow and learn that capture our interest and sort of attract us in the way of investing our time and our energies and our thinking. And I think, you know, when you're young and there are lots of opportunities presented to you, it's understandable that we would gravitate to things that we seem to be good at and that we think that we're good at and we like and that bring us pleasure and that we find rewarding and all the many ways we can say that same thing. But I think what happens as we age, our lives change for lots of reasons. But some of it has to do with our work life, and it might involve having children and being a parent and having job responsibilities that probably increase in terms of our maturation and gain experience, those kind of things. But an inevitable part of growing older is losing capacity. even though that's kind of a downer to bring up, but let's just get it on the table right now. is that, you know, our bodies and our minds, we know that our minds peak in our mid to late 20s. And after that, as Art eloquently says, they begin a long, slow decline. But we hasten to add that the upside of that is that the decline is long and slow. And what we know about brains is that active brains are healthier brains, and learning brains are healthier brains. And typically, you know, when we sort of get into grooves that we find very comfortable, and some people might even call them ruts, we miss opportunities to encounter other things that may, in fact, be satisfying and interesting and pique our curiosity and that kind of thing. And one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is not letting the groove become a rut.
There you go.
Just groove.
Just there groove. We go. Just groove, baby.
So it's not just that as we get older, we start shedding opportunities to expose ourselves to new and interesting things. You know, just like they say that eventually people come to resemble their pets, I think actually the human race comes to resemble its business model over time. And the modern corporation is organized around the themes of efficiency, repeatability, and reliability. If you think about the way we've structured companies, it really is, you know, what, you know, Henry Ford, you know, we try to do the same thing over and over and over again as cheaply as possible. And that ethos has not only been a big part of the way we structure corporations, it has pervaded the way that we think about ourselves. It is the thing that makes us ask ourselves, do I need to know this? Is this important for me to do? You know, is this, you know, what is the right thing for me to do right now? And so we often evaluate the opportunities in front of us by whether they're useful, right? So I like Bob despite the fact that he's useful rather than because of it. Right, and I think that we have to recognize that actually trying to figure out only the, you know, what is most efficient for us to do will lead us to keep repeating ourselves, to keep doing the same thing over and over again, and that actually there's a tremendous value in actually exploring things for which there's no obvious purpose right now. And so another theme for this evening is the willingness to do things without actually having any clue why they're useful right now, not just because they're going to be useful in the future, but just because, right? We don't have to justify everything we choose to do by the fact that someday it might turn out to have been some use for us.
And I mean, that there's a real tension there right now, I feel, because like everything about the way that we talk about design to the way that we talk about efficiency, it's everything is moving toward this direction of making things happen faster and less expensive and with less weight. And so like, talk about how you kind of deal with that tension.
Well, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about recently, I don't know what prompted me to get off on this track, but it is how much of what's good happens slowly. I mean, if you think about a good meal, a good conversation, good sex, I mean, it's not fast, you know? I mean, fast is not, getting it over with quickly is not optimal, you know? And I think one of the things that Art and I bemoan the fact that many times we ask our students, you know, how's it going? Or even our colleagues for that matter. And the go-to response is busy, you know, as if that's good. You know, and actually the things that unfold slowly over time are often not immediately apparently useful, and yet they may be very rewarding and very satisfying. And I think when we start to say that I should be looking for things that are of value beyond just the fact that I feel rewarded by doing them, we change how we apportion our time and where we put our priorities. Because if I think I need to just seeking out what's going to advantage me in the future in some way, which many of our students, you know, I mean, we're old, we're tenured, good God, you know. But for our students who are still on an upward trajectory, or would like to be on an upward trajectory, and they're thinking about how can I position myself in a way that's going to lead to some happy station in life eventually, I think often they unfortunately miss many opportunities to right now experience something that is potentially meaningful and rewarding and joyful, because they're thinking about many steps down the road when in fact it's impossible to predict many steps down the road, and what you ought to be doing is sort of savoring the possibilities you have right now.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that the world is constantly changing. And the information landscape in particular is changing. And one of the things that makes humans remarkable is our ability to adapt to changes in information landscapes. So unlike, you know, the deer that roam the neighborhoods of Austin that are really well adapted for a single environment, and that single environment is not semi-urban Austin, Texas, when things change for them, it's a real catastrophe. But what humans are particularly good at, even though we don't always like change, we are good at figuring out how do I navigate this new situation. Now, the best way to be prepared for those new situations is to be constantly preparing for change, to be exploring all sorts of things that are different from our current environment. And one of the reasons why that's valuable is it reduces a lot of anxiety. So one of the things that Bob and I've talked about on the show a lot is that the human mind is a prediction engine, and as a result, it likes certainty. It likes to know what's going to happen. We gravitate towards familiar situations in part because they feel good to us. And when we go into a situation that is unfamiliar and unpredictable, we meet that with a little bit of trepidation. But the more that you are willing to expose yourself to new things that you haven't encountered before, the more that you realize that most situations that have uncertainty to them, while they feel a little off, generally work out okay. And so what happens is the level of anxiety that you experience around new things starts to go down, because you become the sort of person who says, you know what, I'm going to work this out. And so the best way to adapt to a world that has a tremendous amount of change in it is to just be willing to face all sorts of new and unpredictable things, even when you don't have to, so that when you do have to face something that's a change, you're actually really well prepared for that.
Yeah.
Already.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that different individuals find what Art just described easy or hard, depending in large measure on genetic predispositions. I mean, we've talked on many shows about the so-called Big Five personality characteristics, and some
they're big, and there's five
of them. That's right. We're psychologists. Much of that is attributable to what you come with. But I think what Art mentions about how you create experiences for yourself that within the range of tolerability, you say, well, here's a thing that I don't know about, or I'm not sure how I do at this, or I'm not sure I'm going to like it, right? But the investment isn't that big, right? So for some people who have huge openness to new experiences, yeah, I try anything. You know, I mean, I don't care. Let's go for a week to this place I don't know anything about, and, you know, see what it's like to sleep on the dirt or whatever. But I think for many people who are more cautious and more reticent to try something new, you think, well, okay, so don't try a week, right? Try like cooking
a YouTube video of it.
Yeah. better, right? I mean, try cooking some little thing that doesn't take very long to cook and you've never tasted anything like that before and just see what that's like. Because as Art's saying, what sort of propels us forward into a willingness to try different things is a history of successful outcomes, right? And if, of course, we're smart enough generally to predict with some measure of accuracy whether something is likely to be, you know, lovely or disastrous. But if they're small things, if one is a reticent person, then the disasters are not really disasters. They're small little, that was a mistake, right? And I think for many of us who experience predictable lives and it feels pretty comfortable, it requires a deliberate push from ourselves to say, you know what, this is the thing I usually do. I'm going to see what happens if I did that, knowing that the risk is relatively low.
And this gets back to the epidemic of busyness that Bob was talking about, because if you're going to take some of your precious disposable time and spend it on something new, then you have to believe that you actually have the time to do it. And so for everyone who just walks around all the time saying, I'm busy, I'm busy, I'm busy, you know what? We're not that busy. Honestly.
Shocking.
Look at that. You know, the amount of time that people are spending on Twitter and Facebook and screens and things like that, we're not as busy as we think we are. We've
Preach.
Created a sense of busyness.
Yeah.
I'm feeling it here. But because we feel like we're constantly doing stuff, we feel like we're busy, and then we talk ourselves out of what would actually be really great experiences because we've deluded ourselves into that sense of busyness.
Amen, brother.
And so just, you know, put the screen down, you know, and actually, you know, try a couple of new things. It's really all that stuff you think you have to do, it'll wait.
You know, there's one thing that I'm thinking about as you're talking about this is this idea of getting lost and getting lost safely and the opportunities that we have as children to get lost safely, because we kind of never know where we are, but we always know we're with our parents, or, you know, if we've had kind of a safe, relatively calm childhood, we've had those experiences. And then as adults, we don't really have those spaces where we can safely get lost. I guess unless you're in like a thrift store or something, and we gravitate toward those places, you know, like, oh, this is a place I can safely get lost. Yeah. But talk a little bit about the importance of getting lost.
Well, you know, I mean, we often, unfortunately, say to students, which is a very terrible thing to say to students, you need to find your passion. We've talked about this before, right? As if, you know, your passion's in a closet somewhere and you're going to uncover it and then suddenly
behind
the tennis racket. This is what I was meant to do, right? And actually what we understand very well about people becoming passionate about something is it requires an investment on the part of the individual, right? I mean, passion doesn't just spring forth because there's something that you feel passionate about. I mean, there'd be things you're very much attracted to, but in order to genuinely be passionate about an idea or an activity or whatever it happens to be, requires some investment on the part of the individual. And that investment is something that is now uncertain, because you have this thing that seems in some ways immediately attractive, and now you're going to have to invest some self in that. But one of the things that investment does, it gives you the potential to be, as you described, Rebecca, to be lost a little bit. You know, I lost track of time. I mean, I'm doing this thing. I co-teach a class with a wonderful colleague, and this graduate class meets at 2:00. And I got a text from her at 2:03 that said, "Are you coming to class today?" Because I was in my office and I was typing. And I just paragraphed, it was so lovely. You know, I was just creating this thing and I just lost track of time. I forgot my class started at 2:00. I forgot it was 2:00.
Shocked.
Yeah. But I think those moments of investing oneself in something, even something that seems, you know, trivial. I mean the paragraph wasn't that great, but just the idea that you could become so engrossed in something that time seems to pass unawares. You know,
and the beauty of this is, you know, everyone. So here's a little insight here. Everyone should treat their lives like we treat Two Guys on Your Head, this show, which seriously,
I can't wait to hear this.
Okay. We get 7.5 minutes in which we're supposed to say something interesting. And that could be a tremendous amount of pressure if we thought we had 7.5 minutes to come up with something interesting. But we don't. We have as much time as we need to say stuff because of Rebecca. So, you know, we've talked about this before. She basically creates, you don't know this, she creates a ransom note in which she takes individual words that we've spoken and weaves them together into complete sentences that then are, so.
This is not an ethical way to edit for anybody coming up. But
apparently an effective one. And so we get lost, you know, for 30 or 40 minutes at a time. And then at some point we pop back up and say, is there a show there?
Yeah.
And then usually Rebecca goes, no, not yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we dive back down and get lost for about another 20 minutes. And we pop back up and she's like, almost. And we get lost again. And then she's like, okay, now we got it. And then we can move on to something else.
Now Art's not saying that in order to have a happy life, you need a producer.
Right.
Yeah, because it is to our great advantage to have a producer, but you know.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's right. But it's that willingness to not obey what you think is the constraint on your life. So you might think the constraint on your life is it's got to fit into 7.5 minutes or whatever it is. But no, you actually, the joy of it is getting lost. And along the way, you will achieve a lot of these other goals, but you'll achieve them better by actually allowing yourself to explore and to get lost and to have people around who will tell you, yeah, I think you're there, or no, you're not.
And you know, it's really interesting actually that you bring up the show and the way that we do it, because it is also not really a natural, or it's not really protocol, like that's not the protocol people use to create shows. No. So we've gotten a lot of slack. Well, you guys haven't, but like I've gotten a lot of slack for being like, when are you going to even start recording? Like, what are you doing in there? You're just hanging out and talking and like laughing and like, what are you guys doing in there? And I'm like, don't worry about it. Like that's what we do. And I think that you have to be able to say, this is what I do. You know, like, it's okay. It doesn't have to look like it fits with everything else. It doesn't have to look like it makes sense. That doesn't really matter. You know, if I want to look like I'm making sense, I'll work at a bank or something. You know what I mean? Like, I think that is something that you constantly have to push against when you're really trying to create or do something, is that expectation that it's supposed to look a certain way.
You know, and that brings up the thing I mentioned earlier about being on a schedule, right? And having to say, this has to happen by X hour and X day. And that is stifling, right? And if your whole life involves only those kinds of things where something has to happen by X time on X day, you're pretty much going to be unhappy, because there's just too many constraints that keep you from getting lost. I mean, I often... You know, I'm an academic advisor for our undergraduate students, and I often say, you know, you need to take more walks. You know, you need to take your earbuds out and walk, and just look around at what you're passing. And I was walking over Waller Creek Friday, and there was a heron in Waller Creek. You know, it was a hare in Waller Creek. I'd never seen a hare. And when I said to other people, I say, oh, yeah, like I'm supposed to know that, you know, but I just stood there and looked at this heron. Now you might think, you know, look, you're a professor. You can do whatever the hell you want. But I want to tell you, as Art said earlier, we have opportunities that we don't notice and we let pass to stand on the bridge and stare at the heron. because we think, what good is that going to do? Well, you know what? I have no idea what the hell good that did.
You got to tell this story in front of an audience.
Well, exactly. But I wasn't planning it then, right? But the idea that, you know, that time, and I didn't stand there for an hour. I stood there for 5 minutes, right? But there's a rewarding feeling that comes from just seeing the world, you know. And I think, you know, mindfulness is big sexy thing now, you know. I don't know if this is that. That seems more spooky than I want to get into, but I just think the idea of what everybody's talking about really is just noticing more about what the hell's going on. I mean, we kind of zoom through life very goal-directed, you know, like I'm going to accomplish this and then I'm going to get to that. And all the distance between now and accomplishing that goal is invisible, right? Because I'm just thinking about this and getting to there. And all the stuff that happens in between just seems like some fodder that I need to encounter and get through to get to the end goal. When in fact, a lot of that fodder is just lovely. You know, and it's not fodder. It's actually the stuff of your life experience.
Yeah. And, you know, goals are wonderful, but they're overrated. I mean, achieving goals is overrated. Look, we want to have things we're striving for. I'm not saying let's all, you know, be lazy and not ever be productive. Don't, you know. But, you know, achieving goals doesn't make you happy. We've talked about that. We've talked about the hedonic treadmill before, the idea that you achieve a goal and then you're happy for like a week, after which you're the kind of person who achieved that goal and now you got to do the next thing. And so if you're miserable when you haven't yet achieved the thing you're trying to achieve, then you have brief periods of joy punctuated by long periods of frustration and anxiety, which doesn't seem like a great way to go about your life. And on top of that, you know, when you achieve the goal, if that was the only thing you were trying to do, now what? You've achieved the goal. Now I'm adrift after that. I mean, think about the people that you know, for example, who you know, they're constantly goal directed and they're constantly focused on their work, right? And then they retire and they have nothing else because they've only been focused on the next goal at work. Well, now they get to the end of it, and these are people who have a very hard time because they're adrift, because they never just stopped to look around and realized actually sometimes it's just fun to look around, or sometimes it's just fun to read a book, or sometimes it's, you know, it's very hard if you get to retirement and that's the first time it ever occurs to you that you might also do something else.
You know, we've talked several times about regret, and you know, when you ask people who are young what things they regret, they talk about things like that happened this week, like I got loaded and, you know, passed out in some terrible place.
And it's all dumb things they did.
And it's all dumb things they did. But for older adults, and you ask them what they regret, it's all stuff they didn't do. You know, I realize that I'm now at this point in my life and I never fill in the blank. And one of the things we write about in Brain Briefs, available on Amazon.com, by the way.
Look at you!
Look at you taught me!
That's so good!
My work here is done.
That's right. So, you know, I wrote this thing about, because art is a great example of this, right? Because, I mean, many people like who have aspirations like art, you know, would be, you know, surrounded by their family at the end of their lives and saying, you know, I always wished I'd played the saxophone, you know. I mean, some people say that. But Art actually, you know, in his 30s, right?
Yeah.
Said, I'm going to learn to play the saxophone. And he learned to play the saxophone. You know, and I think that kind of choice, you know, that many of us don't think we have because it seems too daunting or it takes too much time or it's, you know, it's too much effort or whatever. Those kinds of things that provide a variety of experiences in our life afford us opportunities to continue to do things that are meaningful to us when some of the things that we do now are no longer a part of our life experience because our bodies and our minds won't allow it. I mean, I think, you know, I had an interesting epiphany a couple of months ago. I went to an audiologist and had a hearing test, first hearing test I've had in 5 years. And when I was a teenager, I played rock and roll. When I was in college, I made a lot of money playing rock and roll. And, you know, because people are that age feel like they're invincible, I never wore ear protection. I just, you know, banging the hell out of a drum set and the bass player right behind me, you know, with his Marshall amp and, you know, and I've lost a considerable amount of my hearing. Now, I'm a musician, you know. But what's interesting to me is when I had this hearing test a couple months ago, I realized how much my upper frequency perception had diminished since the last time I had my hearing test. And there was a moment when I started thinking to myself, this is the first time when it's really hit me in the face that there are aspects of my human capacity that are now diminished and are never coming back. You know, I mean, exercise isn't going to do it. I got no drugs to do it. No surgery is going to do it. There are aspects of my human functioning that are diminished. And if everything that I had and everything that brought me joy and pleasure was riding on that one thing, then this would be devastating. Now, it's not a happy thing, you know, but the fact that I read books, I write, I have nice friends, I have grandchildren, I have all these things in my life that as different capacities begin to diminish, there are other ways for me to invest myself that nevertheless bring me joy. And so the things that go away are not so devastating. They're not so diminishing of my life experience because of the diversity of experience I have. And I always have to get this in when we talk about something like this. We never quote Freud about most things because he's wrong about almost everything. But one thing that Freud is absolutely right about is that happiness is a function of meaningful work and meaningful relationships. Now work may not be work like getting paid for at work, but stuff that you invest yourself in that actually accomplishes something. And you know, the more narrow our life experience, whether it has to do with the people in it or the tasks that we participate in, then the fewer options we're going to have when the things that we're used to doing become more difficult or become impossible, right? And I think I very appreciate Rebecca bringing up a topic like this about diversifying your life, because lives change, our bodies change, our minds change, and the more various our experiences are and our capacities are, then as things start to drop away, we have many things that are still there to sustain us and bring us joy.
But I have to clarify, Art texted that he wanted to do the show on diversity, not that special. Okay. But thanks for the credit anyway. I like it. But
We share.
I want to open things up for questions in just a second, but I think one thing that you talk about, which is really interesting, is the effect of trauma on our ability to think about diversifying our interests and even taking risks, you know? And I think like what you mentioned about, well, just try a little something new, how important that is. You know, I got in a ski accident a couple years ago, and now I'm like gun shy for even walking on the sidewalks with the scooters walking by. Like I'm like, meh. But it's really kind of interesting and how that changed my perception of what I could and couldn't do. Yeah. Yeah. And even having children, you know, it's like I haven't been skydiving since I had that one over there. And I don't think I'll go ever again. Yeah. But but when I go to the grocery store, if I see some strange octopus-shaped fruit, I'll try it, you know? Yeah. But I want to talk a little bit about how you can force yourself, how you can recognize that you're scared of these things and then kind of get back into trying a little bit at one at a time.
Well, I think it's that first bit of recognizing that you're scared of something. So the thing about emotional experience, and we've talked about this on the show occasionally, is that the feelings that you get are a reflection of what's going on in your motivational system, and then you have to interpret them in some way. And a lot of times you look for some obvious thing in the environment that you're going to attach the feeling to and say, well, that's the thing that I'm bothered by. And so if you're in a new environment, then you feel a little unsettled just because it's unpredictable. And if you've had some difficult experience before, that feeling may be magnified a little. So now I may go from just being unsettled to being deeply anxious about what's going on. And now I look around the world and I'm trying to explain what is it that makes me feel so anxious and fearful at this moment. And I find some object in the environment and I say, it's that. That's the thing I'm afraid of. And then that begins to feed on itself, because now when I see that thing again, I'm reminded that the last time I saw that thing, I was afraid of it. And now I re-experience some of that fear and anxiety. So how do you get out of that? The first thing you have to ask yourself is, when you're feeling this kind of fear and anxiety, you have to look around and say, wait a second, what's really going on? Is that thing really that scary that I should be afraid of it? Or is it something else? Am I reacting to this past experience? Am I just reacting to the novelty of this situation? And if there's no real danger out there in the actual environment you're in, which is often the case, right? We have created environments in which even the stuff that's really scary isn't that scary. Just as an aside, how do you get undergraduates to experience stress and fear in an experiment? You tell them that they're about to give a public speech, which doesn't kill many people.
Well, so sometimes the listeners.
Right. Well, that's they're wishing. It's different. So when you look around the world, most of the things that are out there don't warrant the level of fear and anxiety that we place on them. And if you find that that's actually the case, then you can now open up an opportunity. You know, and you may not be able to do it alone. You might need someone else's help, particularly if that fear and anxiety is strong. But you open up that opportunity to say, you know what, I am just going to try this. I can get up and do this, and take those kinds of small steps that Bob was talking about. But it starts with actually being willing to take a reflection on those items and really decide, is my reaction worthy of the situation.
So let's open it up for questions. And I think Amy Chambliss is coming with the mic. She's back there. Is it possible to turn the lights up just a little bit, Chris? Oh, yes. Thank you.
People.
So just raise your hand and make sure that that you have a microphone before you talk, because we want to get you on the podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so I guess my question is more maybe a little bit driven by my profession right now, but I was kind of wondering if there's been any studies or discussion around how our ability to try new things and kind of just change our routine is a function of how our social interactions with each other have evolved over time and our culture. For example, like if I go visit my family in Costa Rica and we go on a Walmart run, we're there for hours, like meeting people in the aisle. It's like a party. And in the United States, you just get in, you get out, you leave, you make no eye contact. Like you don't want to have any social interaction. And so that to me was like a big jarring difference of why like I felt like being in Costa Rica was just way more fun and the people were more warm, and because like a task in itself wasn't just a task. It was actually, you know, an experience and you could find people you knew there. So I was just wondering if that has been anything that's come up.
Well, yes. I mean, we say this all the time. It's so hackneyed now. We're a social species. Right. And the reason our species has thrived over millennia is because of our cooperative spirit. And I think the description of your family in a Walmart in Costa Rica, where you see people and you have conversations with them, I mean, like it's a party, you know, if you think about why wouldn't that happen here? I mean, it's almost always because somebody's in a hurry. You know, it's not because I don't want to have a conversation with somebody necessarily. It's because I feel like I got to be home by 4 o'clock or whatever, you know, whatever constraint you feel like is operating in your life. And I think, you know, we certainly in an achievement oriented, highly scheduled society, which is what this is, we have a different value system about what's worth your time. I mean, in Costa Rica and many Latin American countries, the idea of having a conversation is like a really valued thing, you know, and the idea that you would spend time and delay the accomplishment of your shopping errand is like, well, so what? I mean, I'm talking to Art, I'm talking to Rebecca, it's a lovely thing. But that's not the ethic here. So certainly the cultural expectations have a great deal to do with what people are willing to do and seek out in terms of their own experiences.
There's another thing too, which is, and we've talked about this a little bit on shows, but sociologists will tell us that there are three main types of relationships that we engage in our lives, right? There's family, neighbors, and strangers. And we live in environments that have a very low density of neighbors in them. So the thing about being a stranger with people is you don't know them, they don't know you, you don't owe them anything, and if you give transactions with them are all sort of cash on the barrel now. It's all very businesslike. Which is why, by the way, when you go to Whole Foods and the cashier says, "How are you doing today? Tell me, what are you doing this afternoon?" You're like, "Stop."
They don't do that anymore because now Amazon owns Whole Foods.
There you go, right. So it's all right. It's all business now.
Thank you,
Amazon, just for that. But bring back the produce. Now, when you're with strangers, it's all these very efficient interactions. And with family, of course, you know, you can have long conversations and talk about all sorts of things, and you don't even keep track of transactions anymore. But with neighbors are still people that you want to engage with. You want to have those conversations. You know, when you do engage in a transaction with a neighbor, you settle up over time. You know, you don't have to. You know, if your neighbor does something for you, you don't have to immediately return the favor. You can have a week or whatever to do it. And so the thing is, if you live in an environment with a high density of neighbors, you're constantly engaging in furthering those relationships. Right? And so if you live in a place where you're constantly looking for these people who are part of that community, you have to keep that up. But what we've done, particularly in urban areas like Austin, is we've created a very low density of neighbors that we bump into. Most of the people we see are strangers, right? So you walk through Walmart and it's don't know you, don't know you, don't know you. And occasionally you see somebody you sort of know, and you're just like, "Hey, how you doing?" And then you keep going. But
that's the Walmart in Newark.
In Newark.
Yeah.
"How you doing?" I'm fine. Thank you. Another big cultural difference is that we actually go out of our way often to surround ourselves with strangers because it's part of what allows us to be so efficient. If everyone's a stranger, I don't have to deal with you. Right? And so you support this ability to be really focused on doing the next thing by just not being around a lot of other people who you want to further a relationship with. So, I mean, I think the culture feeds on itself, but the culture also, you know, we create these environments that actually support the kinds of social interactions we want to have.
Yeah. Another question?
Hi. I have a question about romantic obsession.
Fantastic.
Should it be neutralized, or is it okay to just...
Should it be what?
It be neutralized?
Neutralized?
Yes.
Really? Is that what you said? Neutralized?
My horoscope said
you
I should.
You have to hire somebody to do that? I don't know.
It's like an antacid.
In some cultures, they call it being enchanted by somebody, being bewitched by somebody, where you're just kind of thinking about romantically. Yeah. Is that okay?
Well,
asking for a friend.
You're not. Well, you know, I have to say something about that. There are many people in the world who are tremendously attractive for various reasons. I mean, not only their physical appearance, but they're charming, or you know, they're really bright, or you know, whatever. There are all kinds of reasons for that. I think where obsession becomes, you know, deleterious in some way, is that you're no longer happy about thinking about it. You know, I mean, the difference between obsessions that are joyful. I mean, there's some people I know in my life who are, you know, I know them from a distance, and I appreciate them. I mean, they're lovely, and I don't know if I'm obsessed with them, but when they're in my field of vision, I pay attention. You know, but it's a happy thing. You know, I just sort of admire their wonderfulness. But when it becomes not that, you know, when I'm unhappy and whenever they're not in my presence, I can't be happy about anything else because they're not around. Then I think that's probably not a happy thing and not a good thing. But I do think that there is this thing about, you know, what kind of relationships we establish with different people. And I think we're generally bad at being fond of people without the idea that it needs to go further in terms of the depth of the relationship. You know, I mean, there are many people who I admire, I like, I think are beautiful, I even think are sexually attractive, but the end, you know, I mean, I admire them at a distance, and that distance will remain. But it's when that gets, you know, distorted in some way that now other things that bring me joy are fading because this has become such a prominent feature in my thinking. It's not good anymore, you know.
I just want to say one other thing on this, which is generally, you know, just, you know, I think there's a tendency in this culture at times for people to feel bad about doing anything or thinking anything that gives them joy. Like we think, gosh, I should be more serious, you know. Right? I mean, no. I think that,
yeah,
that it's.
And we say that all the time. Yeah.
Well, we don't say that, but I've been around many people who say I should be more serious than this. Yeah. You know, and I don't know. I think seriousness is also overrated, and I think that sometimes, you know, just enjoying something, whether it's a person in your environment or music or books or whatever it is, you know, it's okay to do things that are, you know, that you're doing for the joy of it.
I love the word bewitched that you use, though. It's a really beautiful word, bewitched. Another question?
I can remember reading years ago that there are certain human fears that we're born with, like fear of falling, fear of loud noises. I think I remember fear of making public speeches, but what a newborn would know about that, I'm not really sure. I'm wondering if there are the fear of change is something we're born with, or we develop that as we learn routines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it relates to what Art said a minute ago about predictability, right? I mean, the thing about change that's daunting is the unpredictability of outcomes. Right. Art, I mean, he wrote a book called Smart Change, also available on Amazon. But the whole structure of making changes personally, organizationally, whatever, is the challenge of that is that the outcome is not certain because it's not yet been experienced. And the outcome may initially be worse, even if eventually it will be better. So that's a different way of thinking about that. And I think, you know, evolutionarily, if you've been doing the same thing and you're still alive, all your genes are telling you keep doing that. right? It's working. And it's not, you know, we are curious, but we are not curious to the extent that we risk our safety. And I think all the things that are innately fearful, innately fear-producing in human beings, are those things that create risk of harm, not just physical harm, but emotional harm as well.
And social harm.
So
there's another thing that happens as we get older that I think makes us even more fearful of change. I mean, in addition to just, you know, being physically less less resilient, as you get older, there are certain things you're good at. And you become used to being good at those things. And whenever you do anything new, you're not good at it at first, right? That's the thing. And so, I mean, like taking up the saxophone in my mid-30s required making all of those horrible noises that you hear in TV shows when somebody's learning to play the saxophone. It turns out that you don't just have to be in middle school to make those noises. And so you have to be willing to just say, you know what, I'm going to do this thing, and I'm going to suck at it, and that's okay, right? And I think that a lot of us don't like to do that. We reach a particular level where we think, okay, I'm beyond sucking at stuff, and I think we have to say, no, actually, it's okay. It's okay to just do this thing and be bad at it for a while, and no one's going to get hurt. And I think that's getting over that fear of being the presentation of yourself, that you got to be good at everything all the time.
Well, also in your mid-30s, you've heard John Coltrane and you've heard Coleman Hawkins. Right. I mean, you have good taste.
So when I took up the saxophone, actually my goal was not in 5 years I'm going to be Coltrane. It literally was in 10 years I won't suck. And after 10 years, people said, are you any good? And I said, well, I'm better than anyone who doesn't play, and I'm not as good as anyone who does.
And so, but I mean, that sense of realism in terms of the expectations is a huge deal, right? I mean, if you have the expectation that there's supposed to be some accomplishment, we're back to the goal thing again, right? Is a goal, I have to get there in time certain. Well, now I've obviated all of these joyful moments of learning stuff. And, you know, we've talked about this, I think, on a couple of shows, and I think it's in Brain Briefs, too. You know, we teach second languages at exactly the wrong time in school. I mean, little kids are language sponges. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-olds. I mean, nothing. And when do we start teaching languages? Young adolescents whose social sensitivity to embarrassment is maximum, right? And then we say, what's the word for to be, you know? And they just say, I'm not going to say anything because I'm going to say the wrong word and I'm going to be embarrassing. And the thing about being able to say, you know, I'm going to suck at this for a while, that is a liberating thing. You know what I mean? I mean, really, to say I'm terrible, but I'm enjoying this, right? I mean, my wife is a real pianist, so we have an honest to God beautiful grand piano in our home. I'm an enthusiastic pianist. I love to play the piano. No one should listen to me, but I have a great time, and that's a different way of approaching something that you're not yet masterful at.
Let's take 2 more questions.
Amy, this nice gentleman on the front has been so patient.
This lady also.
Yeah.
But.
Okay.
Someone's going to be disappointed.
I'm so sorry about that. It makes it easy to ask the question when I know I have taken someone's opportunity. But hopefully it'll be useful. I think, Art, you mentioned early on that some of this, the sense of hurriedness that has led to everything else being too costly to engage in, is sort of a reflection of the society, the economy that builds this society. Having identified that, y'all have talked about a few things, you know, looking at the Costa Rican Walmart, we know there may be some negative or harmful impacts on social cohesion. So looking at that, the individual every day has to say, well, I'm going to do this just because I know it might be useful to do something that doesn't, that isn't safe or that doesn't, isn't what I do every day. But when it comes to institutions, is there anything y'all have identified in your research, your study, your thinking about this? What can the professor do, the schools, a government entity, or a CEO do to make sure that his folks are taking those chances to possibly build something better in the long run?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot of things to do. I mean, one is, I think we constantly have to question our reward structure. You know, when I teach, we have a fairly new major here at UT called the Human Dimensions of Organizations, and I teach the intro class. And on the first day of the intro class, which is sometimes the first class any first year student is taking here at UT, and I say to them, your grades don't matter. Right? No, stop paying attention to grades, because years from now, if you do something really nifty, no one's going to say, but what did you get in that class? They're just going to think it was really cool that you did something good. And so it's not about the grades anymore. It's about what you're learning. So I think we have to be willing to question those reward structures, because grades are something that actually force us into efficiency. They force us into studying only the stuff that's related to that class, rather than just studying broadly and learning things for the sake of learning. So those reward structures matter a lot. And then the other thing that I talk about a lot, both here at UT and also when I talk to people in companies, is we have to stop punishing mistakes and failures, because mistakes are learning experiences, and what we also learn about, we learn about what we're supposed to do from what we're rewarded and punished for. And so I say a lot, you know, if you got, like, if like I did, you get punished for stealing cookies when you're a kid, you never tell your mom you stole cookies, right? You would never tell her that, because you're going to get punished, and you know you're not supposed to tell her. So you don't, right? So if you know you're going to get punished for making a mistake, you try never to make a mistake, and then you never tell anyone that you made a mistake. But then you can't learn from it. So what I tell companies all the time is we have to learn to punish negligence, but not failure. So you lie down on the job, you don't try, that strikes me as a punishable offense. But if you try and you make a mistake, let's celebrate that. I actually have told companies that every year they should celebrate the year's most spectacular failure. And honestly, like, not tongue in cheek celebrate it. I mean, really celebrate it. Like, you went after it, you tried, it didn't work, and you learned this stuff. And and aren't we better for that? And I think, you know, those kinds of things are ways of trying to counteract some of the influences that have crept into the way that we think and interact from the business world around us.
And even within your own, you know, world, within your own cube in a business, you can say, I'm going to structure this in such a way where I have wiggle room to not do something correctly without somebody coming down on me. Because all of us have more flexibility than we admit too often, you know? And I, for people who work, I mean, many of the students I work with as undergraduates are going to be in public education, which is the most rule-laden, onerous thing you can possibly imagine. And they asked me, how did you survive in public education? I said, I was a joyful subversive. You know, I found little ways to do stuff that I wasn't supposed to do and get away with it. And it was lovely. I mean, something would happen and I'd do this little thing and it was, you're not supposed to do that. And somebody would say, all right, can you do that? And I said, well, I just did it. I don't know. But and that sustains you, right? Because if you just are just following all of this onerous stuff that's telling you what to do every moment, it's so dispiriting that you just can't take any joy in what you're doing.
Yeah. We'll have just one more question. There's one up there. There's one there.
I saw his hand shot right up the very first time Rebecca invited a question. So thank you for your patience, by the way.
Better be a good question.
I know. I'm one of these people who has this fear of public speaking. So I can testify that actually going up and doing it didn't kill me.
Congratulations.
So far.
There you go.
Maybe now. Yeah. If I kill over dead, you'll know. back in the Great Recession, I found my job unstable and I was forced into learning new things. And the question I have is, it seems like to me, time goes slower in my perception. Is this true?
Yes.
And you're nodding.
Yeah.
Because as I'm learning, because I was in a big rut, that rut filled in. I was no longer welcome in that rut.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to learn new skills. Now I've discovered that it's not only is it enjoyable to learn new things, unsafe, because I'm a very risk-averse person. Uh-huh. But not only that, I think my perception of time has changed.
Yeah.
Because you were, but brought this up, you were talking about aging.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you, you know, if you take the same route to work every day, many of us have experienced, you know, getting to work and not remembering driving to work. I mean, we knew we're in the car, and we knew the last time we were thinking we were in the car at our house, and now we're at the car at work. So something happened in between those two moments of consciousness. But I think what that's illustrative of is highly routinized behavior does not require conscious awareness, right? We're able to operate pretty automatically. I mean, even though we have, you know, different vehicles on the road and we have to navigate traffic signals and that kind of thing, but it allows time to pass unnoticed. And I think what having to learn something new does is it forces you to notice the time, right? Because if I can get from my office and my parking space to my carport, and it'll work all on its own without me, I don't have to notice anything. You know, I can daydream, I can do whatever, and suddenly I'm home, right? Or suddenly I'm at work. But if you have to learn something new, your consciousness literally is raised, right? Because you've got to pay attention to stuff that in routinized things you don't have to pay attention to. So of course time, I shouldn't say of course, but I mean, yes, time is going to seem like it's passing more slowly.
And there's an added bonus. So this is one of these, but wait, there's more. So on top of the fact that in the moment you're paying attention to more things because there's all this work you have to do, here's this other interesting thing that happens. When you look back over a period of time and ask how long did this take or how long did this feel like it took, what you are doing is asking how many memory landmarks do you have over that period of time? And if you're in a rut, you got no memory landmarks, right? Because it's just day after day after day of the same commute, the same work, the same lunch, everything. And so you don't have anything, you don't have any landmarks to remember. But when you're learning all of these new things, you have also laid down all of these memories in this span of time. So you have this high density of landmarks, all of which make you think to yourself, not only did it feel like it took a long time in the moment, but even retrospectively, that was a very rich period of time relative to this whole long period of time where it feels like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's a good place to end on how to expand our notion of time, our perception of time in our life. Any other final thoughts on diversity, diversifying your thought process?
Well, I'll just say one thing about that. You know, There is more capacity to try new things than we often imagine there is. And I think, you know, if there's a bit of advice for all of us, and I'm including myself in this as well, it's to take opportunities, however small, to go someplace that's not on the beaten path that we find ourselves every day. And that might be having a short conversation with somebody who we pass often and never stop to talk to, or, you know, picking up a book and looking at a few pages of something that we might not have thought we had the time to do. I mean, those kinds of things are life enriching, and other than the life enrichment capacity, they have no value at all. You know, good. Really, if you think about all the things that we care most about in life, they're very seldom the things that have some utilitarian function that are going to get us to some other place.
Yeah. And I'll leave you with one last thing, which is there's a lot of research now suggesting that your intuitions about what you're going to enjoy, particularly your intuitions about what you might not enjoy, are almost always wrong. Okay, so You think that starting a random conversation on an airplane with someone is going to be miserable. It's actually going to be great. I mean, there's data on this. You're going to have a much better time, you know, having that conversation. You think that glossing over, you know, something difficult that you wanted to talk to about with somebody is going to make your social interactions with them better, and you're wrong. Actually, you will deepen those social interactions by talking about these things that you were reluctant to talk about. So in almost all of these situations, when you shy away from doing something because you think I won't like it anyhow, you're wrong. So remind yourself that you're wrong.
We say that with love.
And then just go do it.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And we can't end
right
without saying the reason Two Guys on Your Head came to be, and the reason it's anything that anybody wants to pay attention to, is because of that person right over there, Rebecca McEnroy, who is
brilliant. Who is now the producer of an award-winning podcast.
Award-winning podcast. That's right, because we got the best podcast.
And that brings me to my last thank you. We thank your bartenders. We thank Amy and Jake and everybody who's been involved in all this. But really, I got to tell you, for the three of us, we never get over the fact that all of you come out to listen to us talk and listen to us on the radio. And we appreciate you more than you know. And thank you very much. And have a great night. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes Store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.